not the application.
Oh, no, there's no evidence that she knows. Oh, well, I understand. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. No evidence that I know of that. But again, that's not our burden to prove that. And that's and Mr. Warner made statements during the argument that he didn't know about that, that he was unaware of that. The thing is that the Real Estate Commission steps into the shoes of Mrs. Graham. It's very clear, the Act is very clear that that's what, that's what they do. And if Mrs. Graham didn't comply, it's not, the burden doesn't fall on the claimants. It's Mrs. Graham's fault, and the Real Estate Commission has to deal the hand they're dealt. Now, in this particular case, and another thing that's interesting to me about this fund is not the state's money. It's not the Real Estate Commission's money. This is a fund established by real estate brokers by this Act, into which all brokers pay, and out of which aggrieved claimants are supposed to be paid. It's not money out of the state coffers. They don't own the money. They just administer this particular fund.
Do you think that makes any difference?
Does it make any difference?
Yes.
It makes difference only to the extent that the Act provides. Oh, incidentally, one other point, and I'm not avoiding your question. One other point is the Act that Mr. Warner gave you is after the 1983 amendments. The Act pre-1983 applies to this case. And the findings of fact find that the causes of action accrued before the Act, the amendments in 85 took effect. It also states in that Act, and it's cited in the brief, that the Act is prospective only. Now I'm getting to your question. The Act provides that prior to the amendments, it says the Attorney General is only supposed to go after these cases if they are spurious or unjust. The fact that we've gone through all of this all the way up to the Supreme Court is evidence that it's not spurious.
They have proven what they paid.
Exactly. And that's why it just amazes me that we're even here. On this collateral attack issue, the Real Estate Commission has tried this three separate times, this trial de novo idea. And it's been summarily rejected all three times. Those cases are cited, Real Estate Commission versus Century 21, State versus Wells, and Held versus TREC. All three of those are in our brief. They tried it three times. The 1st, 2nd, 8th District Courts of Appeals all rejected that claim. They're not entitled to a trial de novo. It's clear by the statute, and by just reading the statute.
How did you get around Bonneville against Beach Aircraft? If they weren't a party to this case, how are they bound by it?
They were a party to the case, Your Honor. They are subrogated to Mrs. Graham. They are standing in the shoes of Mrs. Graham. Because Mrs. Graham was a party, they necessarily were a party.
Isn't that the result of the statute?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. The statute says that they come in to do whatever they want to do, whatever they deem is appropriate, on behalf of and in the name of. In fact, in my brief at the Court of Appeals level, I said that this case ought to be styled Texas Real Estate Commission acting in the name of and on behalf of Fontaine Graham. That's the appellant, not the Texas Real Estate Commission. They are not the party in this lawsuit. They're subrogated.
I still have a little problem on this dual capacity, and if I could break in now and get to clear up for me. You say that the trustor was related to whoever owned the Cole Brothers Real Estate Agency.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Graham worked for Cole Brothers at the time the will was made or the trust was established?
Yes, sir. Mrs. Neal was her name.
Neal was the trustor.
Trustor. And her, I don't know if his brother or nephew or something, was Coles, who owned Coles Brothers Real Estate, which is Ms. Graham's company.
All right. At the time the trust was established, Mrs. Graham was named as the independent executor. I think this was the testamentary trust, was it not?
Yes, sir. She was named as a substitute. And then ultimately, when Mr. Coles died off, then she became a substitute trustee.
Okay. When did she start acting as real estate agent now? Or did she act as real estate agent when Cole was the trustee?
The firm Coles Brothers was named as the exclusive real estate agent in the trust instrument. Ultimately, she became Coles in 1968, I believe. She became Coles Brothers. And at that point, then she continued to act as the exclusive real estate agent in there. So Coles Brothers, her company, she acted as real estate agent before then. She was just an employee of Coles Brothers before then, and then she ultimately became the owner of Coles Brothers. So she acted as an exclusive real estate agent from the outset in this deal.
Well, was she named in the instrument as substitute trustee?
She was named as a substitute trustee in the instrument, yes, sir. Actually, as a substitute executrix, but it was effectively a trust that was set up.
And it's your contention that there's no conflict of interest there that would absolutely, by law, bar her from acting both as trustee and as a paid agent of the trustee at the same time?
No, I don't think there's any absolute bar to it. I think that what it is, it imposes a separate fiduciary duty on her of full disclosure, which she may or may not have done. Our contention at the trial court, of course, was that she didn't, but I don't think there's any absolute bar to it. She can do it, but she's just got to be real careful about how she does it.
You don't think Section 8, Part 3 was, or Section 8 of the Act here was particularly, Section 3 it was, for saying that doesn't apply to executors, etc., was for the specific reason, the purpose of avoiding situations such as this?
Okay. No, sir, I don't think that. There are lots of instances that particular provision applies to. For example, attorneys are exempt. Attorneys can earn a commission on a real estate transaction, but they don't ever contribute to the fund, so they shouldn't be paid. A real estate broker, a person that just happens to be a real estate broker, that's a trustee, that earns a trustee's fee for what he or she does, the fund shouldn't have to pay for that. But in this case, she was acting in both capacities. She was acting as a trustee for which she received a fee. She was acting as a broker for which she received a fee.
Was she? I interpret some of these findings, the fact to say that she was receiving a trustee's fee along all the time she was doing this. Is that right?
Exactly. Both fees.
I suppose a percentage on the income and expenses of the state she was receiving her trustee's fee.
Yes, sir. She was receiving the fees in both capacities.
Double dipping,
and the court found in the findings of fact. Now, Mr. Warner talks about finding of fact 12. There's nothing sinister about that finding. The fact that the finding of fact was different in finding of fact 12 at the trial court. The court said Fontaine was hired for the fee by the estate. In finding of fact 12, Fontaine was hired as a real estate broker for a fee by the estate. All the court was doing there was just clarifying the previous order that he had already made. There's nothing sinister at all about the way that was done.
What is the basis, though, of the change if there is no evidence presented? It seems like Mr. Warner makes a compelling argument that you tailor this findings of fact just to ensure that you make a valid claim on the fund. As a trial judge, when I was a trial judge, there was a winning party does the findings of fact, and they put everything in the kitchen sink that they can get by with.
Well,
that's a customary practice.
I think what he's suggesting that the trial court didn't know what was going on at the underlying case.
No, the winning party structures the findings of fact, whether there's any basis at all to it or not, to their advantage.
There is no question, and I do not dispute that. We did everything we could do. It was no accident that these findings of fact came out the way they did, because we put on evidence to prove them at the trial court, and we did it that way. The reasons, and there is absolutely no difference in finding 12 and 1 is from the other, except that the word real estate broker was put in there. As far as the capacity, when it says here, Fontaine was hired, was hired for a fee by the estate to manage the real property. I mean, clearly she was hired as a real estate broker. The only difference in 12 is that we put in the word real estate broker. He's hired for the same purpose in both cases. There's just no difference in the import of that particular finding.
There was no difference. Why did you put it in?
Because it follows better. It follows the statute better. I certainly am not apologizing for trying to represent my client and putting putting the thing into clear language, and I was, and certainly all we did when we prepared this was we asked the judge to clarify that point to make it a little more clear. But it doesn't change at all the import of that thing. She clearly wasn't hired as a trustee.
When you asked, when you read that portion about that you're asking the trial court to take judicial notice, it seemed like you were saying prospectively you're going to be asking the court to take judicial notice. Is there any statement at all that suggests I am taking judicial notice of this night, this night, and this night?
Did the judge make such a statement? No.
He made no ruling.
He made no statement like that, no sir.
Except
that
he
did in the judgment. He entered he entered an order at the hearing. I don't think that the court, by the fact that he at the end of this hearing said I'm going to grant the relief requested, he obviously took notice. Mr. Warner in his brief says, when do we object? How do we know when to object? You object after the question is asked. I asked the court in the very first paragraph, I said, I'm going to ask the court to take judicial notice of facts in the case. That was when he should have objected if he had a problem with that. Had he objected, even assuming that he did object and the objection was good, the court still could overrule his objection implicitly by putting it by signing his order. He didn't ask for a ruling, and my understanding of the rules of evidence is that if you're making the objection, then you need to make sure that the judge makes a ruling.
Did you tell, ask the trial court in the presence of Mr. Warner, Your Honor, I'm asking you to modify statement of finding of fact 21 to include that she was acting as a real estate broker? Or just come after the fact, after everybody leaves, they need to structure this finding of fact and this item?
I never requested that the court do that, no. Other than just by preparing the findings of fact. But again, to me, that's not significant. All that is just an additional clarification of what he already said.
Well, isn't the point, though, the court did find it, and the question is there evidence in the record to support it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's evidence in the record, in the underlying trial court record, that's, of course, not before this court, and there's evidence in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. That was what was going
on. Without a statement of facts from the first hearing, kind of at a loss to know. I think the law says you got to conclude everything that the trial judge put down there is correct when the appellant petitioner fails to bring forward a statement of fact.
I think that's absolutely correct, and that's the point that was raised in our brief.
Now, let me ask you one question. I noticed in conclusion of law number 5 of December 17th paper that you gave us, says complainants are entitled to recover on behalf of the estate a sum of $20,000 from the Texas Real Estate Recovery Fund.
Okay.
But you're asking us to approve the $50,000.
This was on the... Well, the one that was ultimately entered, I think that is in conflict with the judgment itself. The judgment itself says $50,000. And the one that was entered in April of 1986, was subsequent to this one.
Subsequent or previous?
It has to be previous.
I'm sorry, previous. You're looking at the December one.
That's right. I'm looking at December. That's the latest one.
The April one wouldn't have anything to do with the real estate recovery fund.
That's what I had reference to when I asked how much are you speaking from the fund. It looks like $20,000.
Well, I frankly hadn't noticed that, but the request had been made for $50,000 from the beginning, and if the court has ruled $20,000 in that particular order, then obviously we're bound by that.
What does the judgment say?
The judgment said that they're entitled to $112,797 and whatever is available to the extent that it's available under the Act. Our position is that we're entitled to $50,000 because there are separate acts that are set out in finding of fact number 16.
So the conclusion of law number 5 says you're only entitled to $20,000.
Right. Incidentally, a point that was made in the as far as judicial notice and how that all happened, in the judgment, the court will find that the trial court did not, in the blank for attorney's fees, he put zero in there. And the reason for that is because we offered no evidence on attorney's fees. And he put, since there was no evidence offered, he put zero in that blank. So he couldn't, that was one thing that would have to have new evidence, would be of attorney's fees. We didn't ask for attorney's fees in that hearing because we knew that the judgment was far greater than what the fund would allow for anyway. So we didn't even ask for attorney's fees in there. And the court correctly pointed out in the judgment that they were entitled to zero attorney's fees because we didn't put on any evidence.
Is there any point of error by petitioner that the judgment doesn't conform with the conclusions of law?
No, sir.
$20,000,
$50,000. No, sir. One of the things that was brought out in the motion for rehearing before this court is that they say that the Real Estate Commission doesn't know what to do with brokers when this sort of thing happens. The Act, prior to these amendments, the Act that applies in this case says that the license of the licensee shall automatically be revoked at the time of an order by the court to order payment out of the thing. So there's no question in my mind as to what they are entitled to do in this case. The ruling was found, and they can revoke that license accordingly.
Absent a statement of facts, Mr. Warner, why aren't you reduced to only one contention, and that is if they act in a dual capacity, they're exempt under Section 4?
Your Honor, I maintain that it's not our obligation to bring a statement of facts on the underlying cause. Even if we had, let's assume that he had all the evidence in there, the state wasn't party to that. And Justice Gonzalez is right. They write these findings and they will front load and get everything they want against the state, which would meet the requirements of the statute. Before
you have a case saying that you're entitled to a trial de novo?
We don't want a trial de novo, but we want the statutory language that says they've got to show that the requirements are met. We think that statutory language requires them at the recovery fund hearing to show that. What if the court found in this underlying cause, as I mentioned before, that it was a licensed broker and the defendant wasn't? If we're bound by that, even if we bring the record up to you, if we're bound by that, we're going to have to pay. But the statute said we can't because he's not licensed.
Why can't the trial judge in this hearing in which you are involved take notice of his findings and conclusions in the prior hearing and readopt them into the subsequent hearing? Then the only way you can attack them is by having a record brought forward of what transpired in the prior hearing.
If we do that, then again, we're binding the state by what went on before when it was not there. And the issues in that underlying cause are not the liability of the state. The issues in that underlying cause against Ms. Graham had nothing to do with the recovery fund, had nothing to do with any of the requirements in Section 8. And if the court takes judicial notice and is allowed to take judicial notice, if the record is brought forth and we're bound by it, then you're taking out of this Section 8 the language which says there's supposed to be a recovery fund hearing, and he has the burden.
You refuse to call it trial de novo, but that's exactly what you're saying.
Well, all right,
try their whole case again.
No, we have never taken that position, and that's never happened. Again, 80% are paid without contest at all. If you look at the reported decisions under the recovery fund, you'll see that an overwhelming majority of them, we have prevailed. And in those decisions, the fund was determined not to be liable. We don't come in here and say, okay, you've got to start over at square one. That's not what the legislature intended. What we say is that on the questions like whether they're licensed, you've got to show that. The questions like, were they acting in a capacity, as in this case, that the fund could cover? You've got to show that at the recovery fund hearing. If we don't require them to do it at the recovery fund hearing, then what do we do, for example, about a case where the cause of action is premised on breach of contract, not fraud? There isn't any misrepresentation. There's just a breach of contract.
What did you do to preserve that error at the recovery fund hearing?
I objected I think the record from page 19 of the transcript forward indicates that we took the position that we should not be bound by the findings in the underlying cause. Maybe we can argue about whether the court can take judicial notice, but I can't believe that we can argue that I didn't object to the court making a decision that would bind the state by a proceeding to which he wasn't present. What if the cause of action is breach of contract and not fraud? You can't be paid out of the fund for breach of contract. That's what the Torres case says. If this decision stands, we'll have to pay out of the fund in future Torres cases, and Torres is wrong. The Heal case that he referred to, and he's wrong about that. The Heal case was decided in our favor. That application for payment was denied. The findings referred to in that case were my findings after the recovery fund hearing that the applicant's attorney did not attack on appeal. We prevailed on it.
Why would Torres be different?
Why would Torres? Because Torres was a breach of contract case.
But I mean, if the respondent prevailed in this case with a breach of contract,
Torres, the court said the state wasn't bound. The trial judge made them put on evidence. At the recovery fund hearing, the victim testified, the broker testified, and the court decided that the fund wasn't liable. They alleged in their recovery fund application, just as they did here, all sorts of fraud, misrepresentation, and deceit. And the court said, no, all you have is breach of contract after he heard the evidence at the recovery fund hearing. That's why Torres would have to be different, because if we're bound by the findings, if we're bound by the judgment, then in Torres we would have to pay because we wouldn't get that hearing.
You mean there was?
There was
an evidence. In the initial trial, there were findings on fraud?
No, there weren't any findings on fraud in the initial trial. What happens is they file their lawsuit and they do what they need to get their judgment against the broker, and I understand that. But then they decide if they want the fund to pay, and they front load everything either in the findings or in the judgment or possibly in the evidence in the underlying cause.
Counsel, these are not your findings, they're not his findings, they're the findings of the court.
Yes.
Of the trial court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I hear both of you saying, well, you don't want me to go, but they were your findings on the other cause of action.
Well.
And his findings, the court
correct.
Is not bound by whatever the trial court what presented to him. They're his findings. He can throw them away, he can prepare them himself. And I disagree with my colleague here that the court is going to sign any findings of fact that are presented to him. He can prepare his own.
Right.
And we don't know in this proceeding whether or not these were the findings of the trial court on this sector, just because they were presented to him. Do we?
No, that's correct. We don't know whether he just signed what he gave or not. I don't know that. I assume that they're
the court's
findings.
It's the obligation of the court to prepare his own findings.
That's correct.
We don't know whether or not he did or did not do it.
No, we don't.
Counselor, and getting back to this question of your right to another hearing, Mr. Hicks pointed out Part 5 of Section 8 says that once the Real Estate Commission has been notified of this hearing, they may notify the Attorney General's office, who may appear on behalf of and in the name of the defendant. How do you explain that in the context of your position that you're entitled to new evidentiary hearing?
Well, the word defendant is used, not broker, salesman, and in the other subsections of Section 8, they refer to judgment, debtor, or debtors. I don't know but what that language includes the Texas Real Estate Commission as defendant. But it says just above that the commission or the attorney general, on behalf of the commission, may defend the action. And we're talking about the recovery fund action because Part 5 in the first line is premised on the entry of a final judgment already having occurred. How do we defend the action if we're bound by everything that went on before? How do we defend it? If the court can take judicial notice that the person's licensed, let's say, for example, when he isn't, we can't even put on evidence to rebut that. If we're bound by everything that went on before, there is no action to defend at the recovery fund here. The requirement in Part 3C1 that says he has to show his judgment is based on facts isn't met at the recovery fund here. We have only contested. We don't want a full trial de novo or a retrial. Most of these cases are default judgments, first of all. And, of course, the kitchen sink is in the judgment and the findings in those cases. And there hasn't been any litigation at all in those causes. So there isn't any re-litigation in the recovery fund here. In this case, and in other cases which are in the minority, where there was a contest, the findings of the court are written by the plaintiff's attorney, and the court generally will sign them. And we're not there to say, wait a minute, that's not correct. And if we're bound by that, then we're not going to be able to ensure that the requirements for payment out of this fund are met. We simply can't see that the statutory requirements are met if we're blindsided that way. All we want is a day in court. We don't want a full-blown retrial. We have contested only questions like capacity. That's the only question we contest. I think I could have defeated this whole claim by saying he can't put on competent evidence to show at this hearing that Fontaine Graham is not married to the Nagels. That's a requirement at the recovery fund hearing. He said he could have testified to that, but he can't testify to that. That's hearsay. He doesn't know. No one was there to testify. So
well,
without the Nagels...
We're seriously contending. Now, this lawsuit was styled the Nagels versus Graham.
Yes.
That was a lawsuit that was filed, and I guess it was El Paso County, wasn't it?
Yes.
And when the Act talks about the defendant in this case, you're seriously contending they're not talking about Graham here?
I'm not seriously contending. I'm just pointing out that they didn't use debtor, which is what they used when they talked about the broker or the defendant in the underlying cause in the other subsections.
Well,
I still would say, even if we say that's the debtor, what can we do after the judge? We didn't get notice of this.
Well, it's not the question of an ordinary citizen being sued without notice. The statute, the legislature specifically set out in here what capacity the AG would appear in representing the, quote, defendant. Now, you've got a defendant who has had a hearing, a defendant who was present in the prior hearing,
mm-hmm.
a defendant who is still the same defendant in the second hearing. She just got a new lawyer. She got the AG in office instead of a prior lawyer, she had one then. Now,
I
seem to perceive you're arguing a due process argument here, which entitles you to all this evidence again.
No.
And I'm trying to figure out where you're coming from.
No, not all this evidence, and we're not arguing due process. We're arguing the statutory language, which says that at the recovery fund hearing, we can defend the action, for example. There is no action to defend if it's over. We didn't get notice of this until after the judgment had been rendered and the time for appeal had passed. We couldn't have entered the lawsuit without notice. I don't know that we have standing in the underlying cause. And the Attorney General does not represent Ms. Graham. We may be aligned in the recovery fund hearing on that side of the docket with Ms. Graham. The statute also requires at the recovery fund hearing that notice be given to the judgment debtor, to the broker, who can come in the recovery fund hearing also. Now, I don't know what she can do. She can't attack the judgment because she's bound by it. But I think that she can, like the state, attempt to make sure that the requirements in here are met. I think the statute, we're not arguing due process. We're arguing this is a statutory right and the statutory prescription needs to be followed. And it says we can defend the action. If he's right, there's no action to defend. It says that the court should be satisfied that all of the requirements of the statute entitling payment out of the fund are met. If he's right, that's already been determined, and we don't have an opportunity at all to see in a case, for example, where they find the person is licensed in the underlying cause.
Well, let's go into that. Rule of Evidence 201E says, opportunity to be heard. This is after the judge has taken judicial notice. A party is entitled upon timely request to an opportunity to be heard as to the propriety of taking judicial notice and the tenor of the matter noticed. In the absence of the prior notification, the request may be made after judicial notice has been taken. Did you ever request the court to say, okay, judge, let's sit down here and talk about this judicial notice. Let's determine if there is evidence in that trial below to justify it.
Not in those words.
Well,
the judge didn't
what did you do to avail yourself of this opportunity to be heard?
I would refer you to the transcript from page 19 on, in which I stated to the court that I felt that we should not be bound by what had happened. I explained to the court our position on the exemption.
Now, this gives you an opportunity, as I hear you complain, it is the fact that you don't know what happened below. You weren't a party, and you're here to defend. Now, if the judge is going to take judicial notice, then this 201E gives you the opportunity to say, judge, let's stop right here and let's examine whatever it is you've taken judicial notice of so I can satisfy myself and my client is protected and assuring us that the evidence is there to support whatever you might find.
Your Honor, I think I did that, but I didn't use those exact words. The court didn't take judicial notice, and so I didn't get up and object to the court taking judicial notice, nor did I request the opportunity under E. The Court of Appeals said I was bound because I waived it. What did I waive? I didn't waive the objection to the court finding that we were bound by a proceeding to which we weren't a party. I think that I did make it clear that I objected to being bound, particularly on the question of capacity in this case. And I don't know, since the court didn't take judicial notice, how else I could have done that. I think at least he ought to have said, I want the court to take judicial notice of these facts, and he didn't do it that way. And I honestly thought he was describing his case, and he didn't put on any evidence. The court didn't say, I'm going to take judicial notice. I didn't get up and say, I object, Your Honor, and let me see the facts. But I did say that we objected to being bound by anything that went on before, to the extent that the requirements for payment out of this fund must be shown at the recovery fund hearing. And that's all we want in the statutory right, is that the prescription be followed. If their position is correct and we're bound, then I maintain that every case will have all those facts in them before we get there. And we will be paying all the claims, any claims, no matter what they're premised on. And this has been attempted, but in the district courts, and most of these cases haven't been appealed, the judges have required evidence. And even though the findings in the application say that the broker was guilty of all sorts of misconduct, in an overwhelming number of those cases, when the evidence was presented, the court determined that the requirements for payment hadn't been met. She didn't act in the capacity that was covered.
Is that because you had gotten notice of these other
notice of
the trial court and you knew about them?
Notice of the recovery fund hearing is all we ever get. We never get notice of the underlying cause.
Then how do you know what went on in it?
We don't. That's why at the recovery fund hearing, well, the judgment, quite often the judgment, not like this case, the judgment will say she violated this, this, and this. She was guilty of fraud, misrepresentation in the judgment itself. And then at the recovery fund hearing, we say, wait a minute, we don't think she did, and here's why. The judge has required them to put on evidence to show the capacity, for example, not the whole lawsuit retried, just the capacity. And when that happens, we've been able to convince, to show the judges that the person didn't act in the capacity. We had a case where a broker defaulted.
When was that case?
The case I'm talking about just now was last March.
Any of these cases happened before January 1987? So that you've experienced this before?
Yes, Your Honor. I've been representing this.
Why haven't you gone over to the legislature and asked them to change the statute to make it clear then?
Because the courts have ruled in our favor, and we didn't need to. I mean, the statute has been followed, and there hasn't been any workable problem with that.
Any further questions? Thank you. The court will take a brief recess.